Hello, and welcome to the Post-Africa, Meanwhile the Comics podcast. I'm Dave Belmore.
And I'm T. Campbell, the one who's not a zombie at this hour, by which hour I mean noon.
Hey, folks, welcome back, or thanks to be back, I guess. For those of you who don't listen to the show regularly, I took a month off to go do work in Africa and then take a vacation, but I'm back now, and it's good to be back, and... T, why don't you introduce our fantastic guest here?
We have a fantastic guest here who's very special to me. Her name is Nancy Schoenberger. She was one of the people who taught me to write in college, and she's a respected author in her own right, and has a very interesting perspective on George Reeves, a man who's been in the news a lot lately. There was a motion picture called Hollywoodland, which some of you may have seen. But before Hollywoodland, there was a book called Hollywood Kryptonite, which Nancy produced with her husband, Sam Kashner, which had similar subject matter and a suspiciously similar slant. Nancy, you did a number of, you've written a number of things over the years and haven't really focused on comics or popular culture. Can I ask what it was about this particular subject matter that drew you and Sam in?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm sorry that Sam, my co-author and spouse, is not here to talk about that, because it was actually his idea. We had just finished and had just published a book on the pianist and wit Oscar Levant, who may not be well known to your audience. He sort of peaked in the 40s and 50s. But actually, you should probably start hearing about him soon, because Ben Stiller just optioned the rights to that book. So hopefully there'll be a movie about Oscar Levant in the near future. But
congratulations.
All that, thank you very much. I guess I could say our beat was 1950s Hollywood, because Oscar Levant kind of made his name first in New York and then in L.A. on a number of TV shows and films in Hollywood. And, you know, we're baby boomers, so we grew up watching that show. And the fact that this was an unsolved murder, never ruled a murder, as anyone who follows the case knows, always ruled a suicide by the LAPD. They never reopened the case. But to this day, and of course the movie Hollywoodland makes much use of this, there have always been questions about that death. And so, oh great, a chance to write about a show we watched as kiddies, and something having to do with popular culture of the 1950s, which I guess is ancient history to a lot of people out there. But I don't know, you sort of still, I think you get hung up on the decade where you sort of come into your own consciousness, and for us that was the, you know, mid to late 50s.
I don't know anything about the 80s.
Dave and I have never done any shows about the 1980s.
Oh, you haven't?
No, that has never been our obsession.
So you're definitely completely contemporary, cutting-edge culture. So I have yet to catch up with you. We'll put it that way.
How recently did we do the 80s cartoon shows, Dave? Two shows ago. Depends
so
on when
this
thing
airs. You did do something on the 80s.
Yes, yes, we did.
Aha. Uh-huh. But anyway, so we like that decade. We like that era. And I guess we're still trying to make sense of our childhoods. It just seemed, you know, I think we were sort of beginning to be under the influence of James Ellroy at that point. And so the idea of writing about a real unsolved murder mystery really appealed to us. And we were encouraged by a boyhood friend. We had already submitted that as a possible idea to our publisher, along with a few others. And with some encouragement, we said, no, this is the one we'll do. And so that's what we did.
Now, do you have actual memories of this, of when it happened, when George Reeves was...
You know, something I really don't... I remember the show as a kid, and I was also, you know, to tie in with your theme, I was a huge fan of the comic book. You know, I always think of Superman as really more of a guy thing, but as a girl, I loved the comic book, and I, of course, I loved Lois Lane. I identified with Lois Lane, you know, reporter, and curiosity, you know, kills the cat, you know, that kind of personality. So I really liked that character. I wore my hair like Lois Lane for years and years and years.
Oh, that's cool.
And, you know, as I mentioned on some other show recently, I learned a lot of things from reading those comic books. One was I learned the meaning of irony, because if you remember, everything is ironic, you know, in terms of plot. There's a lot of dramatic irony in those, in the early Superman, well, in the 50s and 60s era Superman comic books. So I was a fan of the comic books. I remember watching the show, but either my parents shielded me from what happened or we just weren't paying attention, because I wasn't part of that generation that just, you know, knew about the murder or the death, if it was a suicide, it was, as it was considered. And I don't remember knowing about it at all. It was something I came to, you know, as an adult.
Huh. Well, it was a lot easier to keep that kind of thing from children in those days. There's a book I read recently. It reminds me of yours in some respects, called Men of Tomorrow, Geeks, Gangsters, and the Birth of the American Comic Book. And you learn about these familiar names that you may have seen on marquees, and some names that have been strictly behind the scenes, and you discover a lot of what has kind of been left out of the stories of the creations of children's entertainment. It is a fascinating subject. There are a lot of unexplored depths there. How did you guys start to research the project?
Well, the very first thing we did, well, first of all, we got all the clippings that we could. I think we must have, were we Googling back then? I don't remember. It was 1994, I think, when we started doing research, 95 around then. But the first real research trip we made was to Metropolis, Illinois, of course, to go to the Superman Museum. Jim Hambrick owns and operates that museum, and it has every piece of memorabilia having to do with all aspects of Superman, the comic books, the movie serials, the TV shows. He actually had an original Superman costume from The Adventures of Superman, which is hard to get because, as aficionados know, George Reeves burned that suit after every season. He hated it so much. So we went there, and he knew a lot about the case, because, not surprisingly, and had been in touch with one of the LAPD officers who had not, he didn't actually work the case, but he was, I think, a sergeant at the time that this happened in 1959, and he had kept a copy of the autopsy and the police report. Or he had somehow gotten a hold of the autopsy, and he had the police report, and he had shared those with Jim Hambrick before he died some years ago, and then Jim Hambrick turned around and gave us that material, and so we got a lot of information from him, and that's where we began. And then we went to L.A., where a number of people, you know, where anyone who really knew George was still living. You know, we interviewed Jack Larson, a.k.a. Jimmy Olsen. I'm trying to remember now because it's been so long. I think we had a phone interview with Phyllis Coates, the first Lois Lane on The Adventures of Superman. We interviewed, gosh, I'm blanking on some of these names because it was so long ago, but the author of a sort of fanzine article that had a lot of information, Jan Henderson's article called Speeding Bullet. We interviewed him and a number of the widow of Betty Shane, who was the widow of Detective Anderson on the show, Bob Shane. So we interviewed quite a lot of people. Most of our research was, we started in Illinois and then we went to L.A. and did most of our research there.
Now, did you start with a specific opinion in mind and looking for it?
We were totally open to any possibility, including, yes, suicide, because, you know, we didn't know. We just, you know, we didn't have an agenda at all. We just wanted to find out what we could find out, and we were perfectly willing to accept the fact that, hey, maybe the LAPD were right in this. But we did have two, if that weren't the case, we did have two big suspects, and those were the two women he was involved with at the time, because both were volatile, intense women. They both had, well, one had a strong motive, and the other a possible motive. And actually, both had mob ties, which is interesting. And of course, I'm talking about Tony Mannix, the married woman that he was involved with and whom he threw over when he became involved with this younger kind of society, cafe society gal named Leonore Lemon. And she was quite volatile, probably a little crazy. And she had been a suspect. A lot of Georgie's friends hated her. She was very disruptive. She broke up his relationship, long-standing relationship with Tony Mannix. So we had those two women in mind, but we were open to any possibility. I forgot to mention that one of the people we interviewed early on was Milo Spiriglio, who at that time was running the Nick Harris Detective Agency. And those of you who saw the film will remember it was called the Rick Harris Detective Agency in Hollywoodland, but it was actually the Nick Harris Detective Agency. And George Reeves' mother, Helen Besolo, hired them to investigate her son's murder. And we spoke to Milo Spiriglio, who at the time was a young man. This was his first case, but he was on that case, and he was the only one still living who was there and involved and, you know, went to the death scene and asked all the questions. And the first thing he said to us was, Eddie Mannix did it. You know, Eddie Mannix did it for Tony.
Wow.
So, and a lot of people who subsequently researched that didn't really say, oh, well, you know, what does he know? Well, we felt he knew a lot because he was there, and he was also a trained investigator. But we didn't buy it. We said, well, okay, we'll do our own research. Mm-hmm. We'll figure out. We'll try to come to our own conclusion.
if you'll let me go back for just a sec. You said that the agency's name was changed from Nick to Rick in the movie.
Right.
That just seems
silly.
Were they concerned about copyright issues? As long as they changed one letter, they could say that it was a completely different agency, and we don't know what you're talking about with this Nick Harris lawsuit. Because that's something that I've performed and some of my colleagues have performed in comics occasionally. Was it just a mistake, or what's your read?
No,
on that?
It was definitely intentional. Now, I should say that Focus Features did buy the film rights to our book, and we are credited as production consultants, but we weren't really involved in the day-to-day production. We weren't involved in the screenplay, which actually departs quite a bit from our book. I mean, the core of it uses a lot of material that we have in our book, but, you know, the screenwriter also made a whole fictional story that he kind of wraps the story of George Reeves inside of, and that's the Louis Simo character played by Adrian Brody. Mm-hmm. That's invented. I think that's sort of loosely based or suggested by Milo Spiriglio. But my guess is that they probably changed the name of the detective agency just for legal reasons, just so they could sort of have them be the heavy when they needed to and not worry about any repercussions. That's
right.
Done all the time, as you could probably guess.
Right, but the acquisition of rights wasn't as straightforward as we've just made it sound. you didn't... It wasn't a simple case of their reading a book and coming straight to the authors with an offer.
Well, I should say that our book had been optioned already by two other production companies. Actually, I think it was optioned three times. The most recent, well, one of them including David Permit, who made that pretty popular movie about, oh, I don't know, 8 years ago called Face Off. With Nicolas Cage and John Travolta. Yeah. So he optioned it some years ago, but they just didn't get it on the ground. In fact, believe it or not, Whoopi Goldberg was set to be the executive producer on that, but it just didn't happen. We found out about the other production, and in fact, we did go to them and said, wait a minute, you are using a lot of material in our book, and so let's just say we reached a very pleasant agreement whereby they said, okay, we'll option, and then they bought our screen rights.
It's a somewhat complicated situation because, I mean, this happened. It's nonfiction, and theoretically, anyone who went to the same places and talked to the same people could come up with the same story.
Well, yes, and in fact, the screenwriter did, you know, he called us early on when our book first came out and sort of asked for information about, you know, where did you find so-and-so, and how can I talk to so-and-so. So he kind of retraced our steps and did, you know, some original research on his own. And in fact, his film, his screenplay reaches different conclusions. I mean, he, first of all, he decided to leave the question open. And he doesn't come down and say, well, I think this is what really happened, which we do in our book, as you know. And he does, if anything, he sort of leaves you with the idea that it may very well have been a suicide, whereas we conclude that, no, it probably was a murder for hire. So he does depart from our book, and he does create a whole fictional story in counterpoint to the one that we tell. And so you could say, well, okay, he's taken all of these liberties, so is it really our book or isn't it? What we discovered is that, because, as you mentioned, factual information, a book about an historical figure, is not copyrighted by, is not protected by copyright. What is protected is the manner in which you tell your story. And of course, you know, the screenwriter did use a lot of things that we discovered, some which are protected, some which weren't. Some of the ways in which we told the story made it into the screenplay, but along with a lot of other things. So I can say that I wish that we had had a closer association with the film. There are certain things about the movie that I mean, although I liked the movie quite a bit, there were certain things I certainly would have done differently. Obviously, we reached different conclusions.
In the movie's case, a complete lack of a conclusion.
Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly. I mean, that was his artistic choice to do it that way. But it's so hard to get any film done in Hollywood at all. I mean, we've had a couple of other projects that have been in the works for, 10 years or so, that I think that he did an interesting job. Parts of it I thought were wonderful. I thought the acting was terrific. And so, you know, do I wish we'd had a closer association? Yes. Am I glad this got made? Yes.
Well, good. Good deal. The... I think it's... I think that thwarted ambition is usually at the heart of a lot of stories that circulate around Superman. You may be aware that the people who created Superman back in the 1930s, Siegel and Shuster, had to fight very hard to get even a basic stipend as compensation for their efforts, and not before many years, decades of struggle.
They were bought off for a very small amount of money, and then, of course, it became such a juggernaut. But I don't remember what they sold it, the rights for, but it was nothing like what the, you know, property created in terms of income.
Yes. Having been very close to another story of thwarted ambition that is associated with Superman, do you think there's something about the property and people's association with it that encourages them to dream bigger and more recklessly than they really ought?
You know, that's a good question, and a lot of people have asked us over the years to talk about the so-called Superman curse, referring to the fact that, you know, George Reeve had this violent death, and then, of course, poor Christopher Reeve had his terrible accident and his years of suffering and dealing with spinal cord injury. What to say? I mean, it seems to me, if there is Superman curse, it also has to do with the fact that the creators were somewhat ripped off, and that George Reeves felt that his career was ruined by the role. It does seem to bring a little bit of bad luck to people. And who knows why? I mean, maybe it's the original curse of what happened to the creators that, you know, maybe that's sort of, if you think in those terms, you know, their fate, perhaps, you know, if anything, this would be a good plot for a Superman, you know, comic book. Their fate put a curse on anyone else involved with, I shouldn't say that because that would include us. But you do think about these things. Mm-hmm. You do think about these things.
Dave has his own theory about the Superman curse. You want
to
bring that back in, Dave?
Well, I don't know if it's so much of a curse, really. George Reeves, his career was ruined by being typecasted into a superhero-type sci-fi role on a superhero fantasy-type sci-fi television show. I think that's happened to a number of actors in the past.
Well, look at poor Dean Cain's career hasn't been, you know.
And exactly, Dean Cain's career hasn't necessarily really suffered terribly. You know. Not that he ever rose to pinnacle heights, but then Tom Welling doesn't seem to be suffering too much right now either. And who was the voice of the Superman T in the animated series? That went on to have, like, a fantastic acting career before he came back to the Superman television show and then died of old age.
Is that Kirk Allen?
Kirk Allen, I think.
Yeah. He was in the movie serial, too.
He doesn't seem to be...
And the radio voice.
He doesn't seem to be terribly affected by the show, either. He seems to have had...
Someone pointed out that he died of Alzheimer's, but then we pointed out that, yes, but he was in his 90s. So that's not so terrible.
I'm pretty sure it was you who said this in one of our earlier podcasts, Dave, that the real curse seems to be directed at people who play Superman and have some variation of the name Reeve.
Ah, yes, that was the only curse connection I could find. I've always been amused at the similarity in their two names since the beginning. Before I was aware of any kind of disasters or anything like that, I just always thought that was...
Right, and then, of course, before I began this research, I assumed that Steve Reeves, who played Hercules, was related, but, of course, none of the men are related, and, in fact, we know that Reeves, that wasn't his real name, and, of course, it's George Reeves and Christopher Reeve. And then here's another wrinkle to throw into all of that is we were told, I've forgotten now where we... learned this information, but at one point Keanu Reeves was offered the part. I know, it's true, and he turned it down from what we were told, and I haven't spoken to him, but he turned it down because it just creeped him out. He thought it was tempting fate, you know, to be another Reeves
right.
associated with the role. You know, I don't blame him.
And I've always pulled this one out, which is a little further reaching, though, but the Superboy television series. One of the Superboys was a Gerard Christopher. His last name was the first name of the last person who played Superman or whatnot.
That is bizarre. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, you do get to feeling like there's supernatural forces at work here.
I wasn't necessarily
referring to the fact that somebody plays Superman and then ends up in a wheelchair. But the being in proximity to such an ideal of human perfection. Let's see if we can bring this back to George Reeves specifically. When he started his career and through, I mean, he started with Gone with the Wind, which for a lot of people is still considered the pinnacle of Hollywood productions.
Eddie Mannix, a.k.a. Bob Hoskins, says in the movie, boy, that movie made a lot of money.
People in Hollywood have to live in hope to a certain degree. It's part of the job. They have to believe that there's always something better around the corner.
Yeah.
And when someone like George Reeves, who's essentially kind of idealistic about himself and about his talent, is put in a role where it's a kiddie show, and it's a kiddie role, and it's not the not what people aspire to, but at the same time, he is representing human perfection. Might that have been a factor in the disappointment with which he regarded life soon after?
Well, that's a good question, and I haven't thought of it in those terms, because the other element here is not so much that he was portraying this you know, idealized paragon of human virtue and strength and power, but what derailed his acting career was just as much the fact that he was appearing on television. And at the time, you know, mm-hmm. in the 50s, at the advent of the small screen, the movie executives were just, you know, that was the enemy. And they did not want anyone who was successful on television to even be in their movies. Television was the enemy. And today, there's still not a lot of crossover from TV stars
to
movie stars. But it does happen. In George Reeves' days, it never happened.
There's still a little bit
of prejudice against television actors on the part of the studio people.
There's still a little bit of that stigma, I think. Like, if a big movie star suddenly winds up on a sitcom television show, they kind of think of it as... Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's the first impression, you know, like, what happened? Where is his movies going? He's doing a sitcom now.
And look at what happened to... I'm going to blank on his name. The actor... The redheaded actor who left that very popular show to try to become a movie star, and it didn't work, and he ended up back on television. Who am I thinking of? I'm just blocking on his name right now, but he's...
What was the really popular show?
I don't remember. Too many things in my mind.
I have never seen NYPD Blue, but I remember a lot of...
Are you thinking of the...
David Caruso.
Yeah, David Caruso.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And what was the show?
NYPD Blue.
That's right. How fleeting is fame.
And now he's on CSI Miami.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. That's what I'm thinking of. And so he tried to make that switch, and so it's still, you know, it can still work against you, we'll put it that way.
Right. Well,
right. Well, it's been an interesting ride, certainly, and I gotta say, it was really interesting to me. I read your book shortly after I left your class, and when did that book come out? Was it 95?
I think it was 1996.
96 that it actually came out. And just about 10 years later to the day, we have Hollywoodland.
That gives you an idea of how long it can take and how difficult it can be to go from page to screen.
Yes, well, it wasn't a
struggle.
Well, from what I understand, it wasn't a movie that Warner Brothers was terribly happy about seeing released at all.
Well, you know, I didn't follow that aspect of it, so it doesn't surprise me, mm-hmm. because, you know, you don't want to see your hero tarnished. In fact, when our book came out, even though a lot of big Superman fans cooperated with us, some other people who had, you know, written about it or researched it, we got a lot of negative response from them. I'm not going to say names, but we figured it was because we did show George Reeves in his full humanity, which means, you know, a very flawed human being struggling with a lot of problems, including, you know, probably alcoholism, or at least the early stages of that. And, you know, if you love your heroes, you don't want to know. You know, you don't want to think about them as having this kinds of human problems.
Yeah, if you're going to do historical research for people who occupy living memory, I think you're going to have a lot of problems. I spent a lot of this year getting over a historical project of my own, which I don't compare the job that I did to the job that you guys did, but the but it's very chancy, even if you're careful, even if you try to be balanced to portray people and capture their talents and capture their flaws, bring that onto the page, and expect to be criticized. You pretty much have to be.
That's exactly right.
And did you encounter that sort of thing with the Oscar Levant book?
Well, because Oscar Levant was a
Levant, excuse me.
Because he'd been gone longer, mm-hmm. and because his era was really pretty much past. Unlike, you know, I think there's still a lot of living fans of that Adventures of Superman. Mm-hmm. We didn't encounter that very much. But you know, the thing is, when you write a biography, particularly myself coming from an academic background, you really try to be accurate. You really want to get at the truth. And, you know, that's your mandate. And then you are surprised to find that there are people who don't share that mandate. And they don't. They want their... Well, I like the way you put it. You know, they're invested in the image. And so they don't want to know what really went on. And of course, you know, we also tried to do something kind of different for us rather than writing in a straight biography or straight true crime, because it combined elements of both. We also thought, well, this really lends itself to a kind of noir crime story. So we really adopted a kind of persona in our telling of the story where we wanted it to sound like a kind of hard-boiled crime narrative, and so that was another element that we used, and some people didn't like that. They wanted just a straight telling of what happened. So, mm-hmm. I mean, the book had its fans, but it also had its detractors.
Yeah, well, that's the most you can hope for, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. You know, if you're in this business, as you know, you just have to expect a certain amount of grief, but mm-hmm. a lot of people, you know, really did like the writing style. They liked what we tried to do, and mm-hmm. I actually think that the film that was finally made, Hollywoodland, you know, couldn't help but follow our lead and to use that tone, because it's a work of film noir, and that's how we imagined, that's how we wrote it ourselves. That seemed the appropriate way to tell the story. It had all the elements of a good Raymond Chandler story.
Oh, good. That is my memory of it. I need to sit back down one of these afternoons and crack it open again.
Well, let me just put in a plug. It is newly available through Amazon.com, a new edition.
So oh, perfect.
Didn't get a chance to read it, you can just go to Amazon.com and order it through
that. I've got a gift certificate for them.
Oh, good. Well, use it. A good chance to use it.
Excellent.
All right. Well, you have a wide range of interests, and it's an accident as much as anything that your interests have coincided with the interest of this program. But
yes, you're right.
But I think our listeners would probably be a little bit interested to hear what you're working on now.
Well, we've been doing a lot of magazine articles for Vanity Fair. Mostly, again, we do a lot of nostalgia pieces, again, old Hollywood, mm-hmm. and right now we're working on the 30th anniversary is coming up of Saturday Night Fever. So, as we speak, my husband
my gosh,
Sam,
already.
Is interviewing John Travolta by phone, so that's going on. And we're also working on an original screenplay for New Line Cinema. That hasn't been announced, so this is the first time been made public, but it's an original screenplay, which, here's a curious thing, I don't know if it'll be of interest to your readers, but when we started working on it and discussing it with the producer almost a year ago, it involves Edgar Allan Poe, we'll put it that way. It's a contemporary story, and it's a treasure hunt, and the theory is that we're working on is that clues to a real treasure are embedded in several Edgar Allan Poe stories. So I'll just throw that out. And it's a lot of fun, but I have to say that since we began working on it almost a year ago, 3 books on Edgar Allan Poe have come out. So what are the odds of that? It just goes to show you that certain ideas are in the air, and, you know, they occur to people around the same time. But there you have it.
Well, I'm certainly interested.
Good. I'm hoping we can get our movie out there before all those other books get turned into movies.
Everything happens in threes, so hopefully you'll be the first one out of the gate.
Oh, let's hope so. We certainly started writing it a long time ago.
I forget. I have so many conversations these days. I think it was you and I, Dave, who were talking about the 1970s when 2 swamp monster comics were released.
Yes.
within a couple of months of each other, and we thought to ourselves, well, who copied who here?
And, you know, they probably didn't copy each other. It just certain ideas seem to be, you know, I'm trying to think of the right metaphor.
Zeitgeist.
Yeah, something.
Popular consciousness.
So, you know, 2 Truman Capote movies, and they had to delay one so as not to, get it confused with the other one. A few years ago, there were 3 movies out based on Jane Austen novels, and they were all done independently from each other. So it's curious how these things just seem to float around in the atmosphere and people pick up on them around the same time.
There must be a shadowy cabal somewhere.
I don't know.
Well, anyway, it was a real pleasure having you on, Nancy.
Okay.
That's good to
for me too.
Hear from you. And Dave and I will be back next time with something completely different. In the meanwhile, this is T. Campbell.
This is Dave Belmore, and it's been great meeting you, Nancy.
Well, same here. Thank you.
And for those of us who wish to check out our website, you can find it at www.meanwhilepod.com. And Nancy, do you have a website?
Well, you know, I'm working on one, but I'm just very slow. But if anyone is interested in the book, it's called Hollywood Kryptonite, and we all know why it's called that. And it's just go to Amazon.com, and you can put in my name or my husband's name, Kashner, or put in the title, Hollywood Kryptonite. And if you're interested,
all right,
pick it up that way.
Great.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Signing off.
Signing off.